KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Katie Jane and the Celtic Light Orchestra performance on Saturday, January 25th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Community Music Center in Portland. Katie Jane and the Celtic Light Orchestra combine Celtic music, interactive lights, Irish dancing, and fun. Pre-show attendees are invited to participate in the magical music petting zoo, where they can touch and play instruments that inspire the creative mind. Again, that's the Katie Jane and Celtic Light Orchestra performance on Saturday, January 25th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Community Music Center, 3350 Southeast Francis Street in Portland. This is an all-ages show. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Portland Chinatown's 5th Annual Lunar New Year Dragon Dance Parade on Saturday, January 25th from 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. The New Year Dragon Dance Parade to celebrate the Year of the Rat begins at Northwest 3rd and Davis at 11:30 a.m. and ends at the Oregon Historical Society. Live afternoon performances and activities will begin at 1:30 p.m. Again, that's Portland Chinatown's 5th Annual Lunar New Year Dragon Dance Parade on Saturday, January 25th from 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. The parade begins at Northwest 3rd and Davis at 11:30 a.m. and the activities and performances begin at 1:30 p.m. at the Oregon Historical Society, 1200 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. Information about the parade route, performers, and sponsors can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 9:02 a.m. and we're going to jump right into One Land, Many Voices.
Hello and good morning. You're listening to One Land, Many Voices on KBOO Portland 90.7. I'm your host, Layla Kanaan, and on today's show, I'll spend a little bit of time discussing the peace deal of the century proposed by Jared Kushner, as well as how the U.S. media continually misrepresents Bernie Sanders. And for the second half of the show, I'll be playing a clip from Arab Voices. Stay tuned. So next week, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will be meeting with President Donald Trump and Benny Gantz, Netanyahu's political rival, to discuss the so-called deal of the century peace deal for the Middle East. But I truly do not believe that peace in any form can come from either Trump or Netanyahu, especially because not one Palestinian was invited to talk about this peace plan. As Professor Shibli Telhami said, the White House apparently thinks that the two sides of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict are the Israeli right and the Israeli center, and I think that says it perfectly. Their goal for the peace plan is to essentially annex the West Bank settlements, giving Israel sovereignty over huge swaths of land and removing any possibility of having a sovereign state for Palestinians. And on top of this, Israel's borders will move significantly eastward, cutting into Palestinian territory even further. It is the most generous U.S. proposal for Israel ever, and clearly exists solely to appease Israel. It disregards Palestinian hopes for regaining control of their stolen land and gives Israel permission to expand their territory. The American peace advocacy group J Street stated that, quote, "The plan is expected to be the culmination of a series of steps taken by Trump and his team to advance the annexationist agenda of Prime Minister Netanyahu and the far-right settlement movement in Israel. The known contours of the plan appear designed to formalize, entrench, and legitimize permanent Israeli control of the occupied West Bank and to undercut any prospect of Palestinian statehood via a two-state solution," unquote. And interestingly, but not coincidentally, next week's meeting falls in the middle of Trump's impeachment trial in the Senate, as well as Israel's Knesset debate on whether or not Netanyahu's position as prime minister makes the Israeli leader immune to prosecution on corruption charges. Dr. Hanan Ashrawi tweeted that this is, blank, a lethal diversionary tactic at the expense of Palestinian rights and international law. Criminality plus personal agendas equals no peace, unquote. So, I guess our goals for 2020 should be to not have any criminals in office. And I think we'd like our outcome. So on that note, I'm going to talk about how the U.S. media misrepresents Bernie Sanders. So I'll start my piece about Bernie Sanders with a five-minute video made by Twitter user Orf and posted by Sean King, who's a popular political commentator, that really shows the hypocrisy of corporate media outlets. And I really just suggest that you watch it because it is far more powerful to watch than it is to listen to, but you'll still get the idea. Okay, take a listen.
Bernie is back.
Getting into the presidential race.
Democrats like somebody new, and that is not going to be Bernie Sanders this time.
It's really hard to imagine who the Bernie Sanders voter is at this point.
Bernie Sanders, fall back. Please get away from us.
Senator, great to see you.
Thank you for doing this.
He has a kind of gruff, curmudgeon-y side that is, of course, well known. He doesn't actually smile that much.
It's almost like Bernie can't tell the difference between kids and adults.
All right, I think you're dumb. I think you're dumb if you don't sit down and learn how to read and write. No, you were not born stupid. Come here. The only way I think you're dumb, I think when you think you're dumb, because you're not.
I think you're disheveled, you're unlikable, and you're pushy, and I don't think you should be leading anybody.
Old is too old.
I think the issue is, do you seem like you're in the contemporary world? He's a socialist from the 1950s yelling at people in the same screechy voice, without smiling, without any kind of personal connection. He looked like the angry man in the center of the stage saying, "Get off my lawn." And I don't think that's a good look for the Democratic Party.
I see him as sort of a not pro-woman candidate.
You may have heard the term Bernie Bro.
The Bernie Bro, right? Somebody who's a bit younger, whiter, I think, than the overall Democratic primary.
I'm with my magnificent vanilla brother named Bernie Sanders.
Socialism has been a manifest disaster.
Alec would still be here today if I had known that I could come to Canada.
Alec Smith,
died after trying to ration a vial of insulin when he couldn't afford more.
So his idea about, you know, free health care, he has seen the manifest atrocities that have occurred under socialism.
$1,000 got me 6 months of insulin for my son. That's still less than what I paid a month in the United States.
Gloria Steinem has suggested that younger women are supporting Bernie Sanders so they can meet boys.
Hello, Bernie. We lost our condo, got foreclosed on because of my medical bills.
Like, I don't understand young women who support him.
I trust that Bernie Sanders is going to fight for health care and to lower prescription costs.
Of all the presidential candidates, you're the one that I trust.
Thank you so much for what you're doing.
You're just giving us a hug.
Thank you.
And we got your back.
I think he comes off as mean. I think he's disparaging.
I don't want to overpromise you.
Bernie Sanders makes my skin crawl, and I can't even identify for you what exactly it is.
Bernie Sanders has done nothing between 2016 and today.
Thank you for everything you've done these last few years. You've helped to reset our political discourse and are demanding that we center our politics around justice and equity. I am hopeful because right now, there is a mass movement of people from all over this country rising up.
Thank you all very much. It ain't Bernie, it is us.
If we come together, we will win.
People always say, oh, you're being too vocal.
Hey, Bernie, you don't have to yell.
I don't feel I'm being vocal enough. We are not being vocal enough. When is enough enough?
He sounds very, very shouty.
Louder.
Yeah, we gotta get louder. How many kids are gonna have to make this sacrifice?
And die.
How can you sleep at night knowing that kids can't afford insulin? How is that possible?
It's not right.
As I'm sure many of you know, critiques of Sanders include that he is unlikable, he's disheveled, he's pushy, that he is too old to serve, he's not current enough, and especially in recent times, he's not a pro-woman candidate. We hear criticisms from CNN and MSNBC, which is to be expected, but also from Trevor Noah, host of The Daily Show, who has taken Bernie quotes completely out of context. From Hillary Clinton, who said she wouldn't commit to Sanders if he won the Democratic nomination and called him unlikable, isolated, unaccomplished, and a career politician. And finally, our beloved Barack Obama, who said he would speak up to stop a Bernie Sanders nomination. Now, obviously, the DNC feels threatened by Sanders. He has plans to ban ads from televised presidential debates, overturn Citizens United, and ban corporate donations to the DNC. And despite mainstream media's attempts to silence Bernie and deter his supporters, over half of Americans support Bernie's single-payer Medicare for All, as well as legalizing marijuana and expunging past marijuana convictions. Increasing taxes for the rich, tuition-free college, and increasing the minimum wage all have incredibly high support from Americans. So, in short, something big needs to change within our current political system. And in my opinion, Bernie is the only option, and he's the only one openly talking about how corrupt this so-called democracy that we live in really is. And coming up next, I'll be playing an episode from Arab Voices called Iraq, Lebanon, Palestine, Syria, and Yemen, a look back at 2019. Stay tuned. الشعب مسؤوليتي اللي كانت ربيت بين الغرب وبين الشرق بين لغتين بين بخيل بين فقير شفت الحياه من الشقتين انا مثل الكوفيه كيف لبستوني وين ما شلحتوني.
Good evening, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to Arab Voices on Houston's Pacifica Radio, listener sponsored, commercial free KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices, wishing you all a happy new year. This program is syndicated and it airs on other radio stations in different states in the U.S. Today on the program, as we begin a new year, 2020, and what I'm planning for the show is a look back at 2019 by airing portions of some of the interviews I conducted on Arab Voices with different guests over the year. So I'll be airing segments we covered on Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, and Palestine. Just a few of what we covered this past year. Of course, we have covered a whole lot more on the program in 2019, and you can find a list of those topics as well as an online archive at our website, arabvoices.net. So let's begin with a portion of an interview I conducted on this program on November 20th, 2019, with Raed Jarrar. Raed Jarrar is an Iraqi-American political activist and writer discussing the situation in Iraq. Let's take a listen. Raed, before we talk in details about the current situation in Iraq in terms of the uprising, the protests, it has been about, 16, getting close to 17 years now since the U.S. launched that destructive, catastrophic war on Iraq. Tell us, what is it like now in Iraq, 16-plus years after that horrific war?
It's miserable. It is awful. The situation in Iraq is extremely bad on all different levels. It is bad when it comes to the humanitarian situation. It is really one of the worst humanitarian crises in the region is happening in Iraq with lack of basic services to most of the Iraqi population, especially those millions who are displaced, many of whom still living in camps around the country. Iraq is a war-torn country. The infrastructure has been destroyed. National identity has been destroyed. National unity has been destroyed. And the country is in shambles. Iraqis have lost their loved ones. They have lost everything in the last two decades. And now we're witnessing this uprising by the youth, by a new generation that refuses to accept the deplorable conditions in Iraq as normal.
And we have witnessed and seen those demonstrations, those protests by the youth, like you said, and by the elderly and men and women and from all sects throughout Iraq. And it has been, unfortunately, several have lost even their lives. There are reports of over 300 people killed, more than 15,000 wounded by Iraqi government forces. Mm-hmm. It has been there protesting the horrific conditions and the sectarian divide and so on. So tell us more about this current uprising that started several weeks ago.
So in October, I think the Iraqi political class, the ruling class, was surprised with the uprising, because the uprising was mostly led by young Iraqis who came to age after 2003. And the ruling class in Iraq ran the country for the last 16 years, mostly based on one political theory. And that theory is, we are not Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was a dictator who destroyed you and oppressed you, and we are not Saddam Hussein. And anyone who opposed them was accused of being a Saddam supporter, and anyone who complained was told that this is better than the days of Saddam. So this new generation that never lived under Saddam Hussein does not find that answer sufficient. They don't care about how life was before they were born. What they care about is that they live in a country that produces $100 billion of oil every year. A country that is supposed to be among the richest countries in the world. But it's a country that is unable to provide its citizens with the most basic needs for living, such as electricity and water and sewage and healthcare and education. It's a country that is run by a corrupt elite that rely on their existence. They rely on foreign powers, especially Iran and the U.S., to keep them in power. So that is the game changer. This new generation of Iraqis who revolted in Tahrir Square in the south of Iraq, saying that they refuse to live in a country divided on sectarian divisions. They refuse the ethnic and sectarian religions, the divisions that have put Iraqi Sunnis and Iraqi Shia and Arabs and Kurds and Christians and others apart from each other. So it's a revolution against the foundation of this regime that was installed in 2003. The regime that was installed in 2003 is built on a foundation of sectarian quotas, sectarian allocations, sectarian divisions, where the country is ruled based on people's sects, and politicians are selected based on their sects. You know, the president is a Kurd, and the prime minister is a Shia, and the head of the parliament is a Sunni, etc. And this division has proven to be dysfunctional. This division has proven to be to have been imposed in Iraq with bad faith, with the intention of dividing and weakening Iraq and Iraqis. And these divisions were installed by powers such as the U.S. and Iran and other regional powers who actually hate to see a strong united Iraq. So what the Iraqi demonstrators have been saying is that we need to see a fundamental change in the foundations of this regime. We don't want a small tweak here and there, a prime minister to leave and another prime minister to come in. They're asking for extremely serious changes in the constitution. There's changes in the electoral system that is based on voting for political parties rather than individuals. Changes in the mentality of ruling. All of these things, not because there is some hidden agenda that is behind Iraqis asks and demands. I think the main agenda is that Iraqis want to live in dignity, in a country that can protect their interests and their provide them with the basic services that they deserve. And this current regime that is dysfunctional and corrupt is unable to provide them with these services because it is reliant on foreign powers, because it is sectarian, and because it is built on these corrupt foundations of 2003. So it's a full circle. Like, I feel like 2019, in a sense, is a revolution against 2003.
So that was a portion of an interview I conducted in 2019 with Raed Jarrar, Iraqi-American political activist and writer, discussing the situation in Iraq. Of course, that interview was conducted about a month and a half ago. Things have gotten a whole lot worse in Iraq. Just a few days ago, the United States launched another attack on Iraq, killing dozens of Iraqis. Hundreds of Iraqis went to the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, the capital of Iraq, to protest the attack. By the way, that U.S. Embassy in Iraq is the largest embassy in the world, with some 15,000 workers there. On October 23, 2019, I conducted a live interview with Maya Miqdashi, assistant professor at the Department of Women's and Gender Studies and a lecturer in the program in Middle East Studies at Rutgers University. She is co-founder and co-editor of Jadaliyah. We talked about Lebanon. Let's take a listen to a portion of that interview. So Lebanon, I know, is dear and near to your heart. You're originally from there. And I know you'll be going there soon. But for the past week, we have witnessed unprecedented protests, literally millions, almost 24 hours a day throughout Lebanon. Tell us more about this protest and what is it for?
I think this uprising is surprised a lot of people and commentators. But to really explain it, you have to go back and understand both the sort of recent history and longer historical trajectories. So more recently, there has been really an ongoing economic crisis, political stagnation, and also and these economic and political crises have really kind of led to a kind of paralysis for the majority of people in Lebanon, and I think it just sort of exploded. And the straw that broke the camel's back was a decision an idea to instantiate a tax on WhatsApp, which is and not just WhatsApp, but other internet applications like it, which are about communication. And, you know, keep in mind that Lebanon has some of the highest and most expensive telecom in the world. So this was kind of like the straw that broke the camel's back. But it was also because for the past 2 months or 3 months, there have been really increasingly critical, difficult, and inflaming conversations about an austerity budget that's being pushed through the Lebanese government. And this austerity budget has really been sort of built on the backs of Lebanese people, especially working and middle and lower classes, and not the wealthy. So this was really the sort of straw that broke the camel's back, and people just started taking to the streets. And, you know, it's a beautiful sight. There are many, many different desires and claims, but the most prominent seem to be the immediate resignation of the current government and economic reforms. Now, there are also desires for more, let's say, structural change, including ending political sectarianism. But as of yet, what we're seeing, and, you know, we have to sort of put these numbers in context. When we say like 1.2 million, 1.3 million people are on the street, we're talking about a country that the total residents of Lebanon is 6.8 million. That's the total people who live in Lebanon. Of those people, maybe 5 million are citizens, or up to 5 million. We don't really have very... clear numbers for this. So we're really witnessing something truly historic. It's definitely not something that I thought that I would see. And it's a beautiful, beautiful mass movement.
And, you know, one thing that I've noticed, as well as so many others out there about this current protest in Lebanon, is, and maybe you can even go back, you know, you and I were chatting yesterday, and you were reminding me that yesterday was actually the 30th anniversary of the Taif agreement or accord that ended the Lebanese civil war that lasted for so many years. So over the years, we've seen the political divisions within Lebanon, and we know the political system even is so, I want to say, complicated, with so many different sects and so many different political factions and so on. So they've many over the years against each other and so on. But with this recent protest that just broke a week ago, with those millions of people protesting, fed up with the corruption and with the government and with the austerities and all that stuff, they are all together from all religions, from all sects. Nobody is talking against, they're all talking against the corruption and against the government, but they are all in it together. And it's kind of showing unity, if you will, for the Lebanese people for what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the most beautiful things to see is something that people have known for a while, which is that political sectarianism is really sort of a way to divide people, and it's a tactic that politicians and the political class has used for decades now. in order to escape accountability and to really continue their own corrupt policies and ineffectual rule. And I think what you're seeing now is that people are saying, look, we're onto this. We're onto this game, and we know it's a game, and we're a lot smarter than you think, and we're not going to fall for it anymore. You have to do your work. You have, like, what is your job? What is a politician's job? A politician's job is to take care of the body public. So what is the body public? It's not a sect. It's the entire country. So do your job. But I want to say that I also think there's a way in which the Lebanese system is kind of, I think, purposely contradictory. So it's a system in which you have political sectarianism, which is then supposed to, and political sectarianism, to be clear, is a form of political rule where it's a power-sharing agreement between the largest religious sects in Lebanon. And according to the Taif Accord, which is the agreement that ended the civil war, and, you know, as you were saying, had its 30th year anniversary yesterday, political sectarianism is supposed to be a temporary framework. And by the way, this was always, political sectarianism was always supposed to be temporary, including in the French Mandate Plan for Lebanon, the colonial framework of Lebanon. And political sectarianism as a temporary framework was supposed to lead to the end of sectarianism. So what that does is, in effect, it assumes that the population is sectarian, and it tasks the state with making people less sectarian. And I think what people have shown time and time again is that this framework for understanding Lebanon and understanding people in Lebanon as sort of hopelessly sectarian, hopelessly divided, is false and is a little lazy, and in fact actually takes and reproduces what the discourse of power itself, which is to say, look, these people are hopelessly divided, this is the only way we can rule them, it's the only way we can have a country because they're so sectarian, and this is the only way you can do it.
You know, so you're saying that the political sectarianism and the Taif Accord of 30 years ago, that political sectarianism that was formed and was to be temporary only, and here we are 30 years later and that is still in place?
Right. So the Taif Accord has never actually been fully implemented, okay? The Taif Accord actually calls for political sectarianism to be a transitional framework towards a national, direct, liberal democracy. So in fact, if you look carefully at the Taif Accord, and this is also, there's previous constitutional precedents for this, what it set up as a framework was a one-time election, okay? A one-time election that was supposed to divide parliament between Christian and Muslim representation, and the one-time election of a cabinet, okay, that is divided, and then the immediate writing of an electoral law that is unifies the country and is not sectarian. So it was supposed to be transitional. Now, the problem with the Taif Accord is that it doesn't contain a timeline. It just says, this is what we will do. This is what needs to happen. So every single government since 1989, 1990, has basically not implemented the Taif Accord. And by the way, a lot of times the political discourse, the argument about why we cannot immediately move to a national electoral system and a direct liberal democracy, is the argument people say is, oh, because people are too sectarian. So you can't sort of trust them with a one person, one vote system, because they will automatically vote their sect. So the irony here, of course, is that the people who are directly benefiting from a continued system of division are the leaders of those sects. So it's kind of an interesting but pretty simple puzzle if you look at it, where the political leaders who directly benefit from a system of political sectarianism, and they benefit from it politically, economically, and socially, are supposed to be the ones to lead the people to a non-sectarian future. So in effect, their task with getting rid of the structures of power that brought them to power in the first place.
So that was a portion of an interview I conducted with Maya Mekdashi discussing the situation in Lebanon. On November 20th, 2019, I conducted a live interview with Mohammed Mohammed, Executive Director of the Jerusalem Fund and the Palestine Center. We talked about occupied Palestine and the U.S. announcement that Israeli settlements are no longer considered a violation of international law. Let's take a listen to a portion of that interview. Obviously, we want to talk in details about the U.S. announcement that it considers the Israeli colonies built on Palestinian land no longer a violation of international law, basically countering an opposition to everybody else out there in the world. But before we dive in details into that, if you could remind, because we speak about that frequently on this show, about the Israeli colonies that are built on Palestinian land. What are we talking about? What are they?
Yeah, so just I guess to give a background to everything. So in 1967, Israel initiated an aggressive war. It was invaded the West Bank, Gaza, Egypt, and Syria, and it preempted this war, and you know, they tried to say that it was a defensive war, but there's actually, and that the propaganda really basically that's what the propaganda says, but there's evidence that this war was actually just an aggressive war. There was no actual threat, but anyway, that's a whole other story. But at the end of the war, basically what happened is Israel occupied those areas in the West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, Egypt, and Syria. And so since then, Israel has remained in these territories, with the exception of the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt and Gaza, which it withdrew from but is still really under its control. But anyway, ever since then, so Israel has occupied these territories and also transferred its civilian population there, which is also known as the Israeli settlers. And like you said, they've colonized, and even, frankly, settlements or colonies are both very, those are very nice ways to put it, to be honest. Basically, they've been on, they've seized land that does not belong to them and built their own settlements or colonies, whatever you want to call them, on land that is not for them. So these are what settlements are, and basically it's taken land from Palestinians, also from the Syrians and the Jilan. And since 1967, there's now 600,000 Israeli settlers, around 400,000 in the West Bank, and around 200,000 in East Jerusalem. And this is a huge part of the Palestinian demand for any kind of peace process. This is one of the biggest issues, is the settlements, along with others such as Jerusalem, the right to return for refugees, all of which have been undermined recently.
And it seems that the United States, well, we know Israel all along, and there is nothing really new to me when I heard that announcement from the United States, because what matters the most is what happens on the ground. The U.S. has supported Israel's occupation of the Palestinian lands for many, many, many years. It even funds what Israel does against the Palestinians, including the theft of land and the building of those colonies and bringing those Israeli-only Jews can live in them, and expanding them and taking more lands and more roads to protect the settlements. And then they say it's natural growth, so we need to take more land and so on. It's continuation of the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. So the U.S. has been complicit with this all along. So what happened Monday with that announcement by Mike Pompeo is just nothing more than, okay, so it's an announcement, but in practice they have been supporting this all alone, and they never cared for international law, whether it's legal or illegal anyway.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that, because in fact, with this announcement, at least now it's more open, because like you said, this has been happening for a long time. The official U.S. position until the other day has been that Israeli settlements are in fact at least illegitimate under or inconsistent with international law. But in reality, even though that was the official position, there was never any actual accountability for Israel. It continued to expand settlements. Like I said, from 1967 until now, there's 600,000 Israeli settlers on Palestinian territory. So throughout that time, the U.S. never actually held Israel accountable for that, never punished in any sort of way. In fact, military aid just keeps increasing for Israel. So like you said, it's true. This is really, at least, I mean, it is a shift in official positions, but over time, it's always really been like that.
And there is no doubt in the international arena that those Israeli colonies on Palestinian lands are a violation of international law, are against international law, and the United Nations too.
Yeah, well, in here's the thing. Basically, I mean, this is as clear-cut as it can get, which is why it's funny how they try to argue that it's not per se illegal, because really, so Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949, it clearly states, that, and I quote here, "The occupying power," which in this case would be with Israel, "shall not deport or transfer parts of its own civilian population into the territory that it occupies." And it has done this. That's what they're doing in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, the Syrian Jilan. At one point, also Gaza, they withdrew them, but they did precisely that. There's literally nowhere to argue that there's any way to justify this. This is under international law, and yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable that they would claim that there's any room for argument about this.
And in addition, I remember just 3 years ago, as a matter of fact, it was on December 23rd, 2016, the United Nations Security Council passed or adopted Resolution 2334, and basically stating that Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, including East Jerusalem, have no legal validity, constitute flagrant violation of international law, and demands that Israel stop such activity and fulfill its obligation as an occupying power, as you mentioned, under the Fourth Geneva Convention. So the United Nations, the international law, everybody, of course, except Israel and the United States. Now, Mohammed, I'd like you to speak on also one thing out there, because of the so-called mainstream media or the corporate media. When they talk about settlements, they make it as like, how dare you Palestinians or other talk about, you know, those are Jews living there. They are civilian settlements. It's natural growth, where in fact, those are all those Israeli settlers who live in Israeli colonies are armed. They are stealing the resources from Palestinians. Israel is choosy what lands to steal, by the way, and make it only Jews only. They shoot at Palestinians. They burn their olive trees. They attack their villages, their homes. They occupy them by force. So it has been nothing but violence and threats from those Israeli settlers on an ongoing daily basis towards the Palestinians in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem.
Yes, yeah, no, and I'm glad you bring that up, because they're not just, you know, innocent, you know, settlements in the Palestinian territories. The bigger problem is that Israel in the West Bank, for example, Israel consumes 86% of the water resources in the West Bank. So that's just one example. And what they do is, so they're not there just to have little tiny towns for themselves. They're also plundering the resources. And in the case of the water, actually, it's funny, or it's not funny, but it's sad, because Israel sells back the water to the Palestinians, to the Palestinians' water, but they end up selling it back to them. It's also probably not a coincidence that Area C of the West Bank, and this is, Area C is a territory where Israel maintains full control of everything there. The majority of the land there in Area C is where most of the agricultural land is. So the same thing, also their settlers in Area C plunder the agricultural aspects of Palestine. And, you know, these things, it's not a coincidence. And that's the problem. Israel has complete domination over Palestinian life in the West Bank. Israeli settlers have much You know, they have preferential treatment with everything. They even have their own segregated roads. I mean, imagine that here in the United States, if you had roads only for white people and roads only for another group of people. I mean, that's just, you know, it's unacceptable.
Mohammed, do you see this latest announcement by the United States, by the Trump's administration, that it's not illegal for Israel to have those colonies on Palestinian land, that this is a boost to Netanyahu's internal use, you know, with the current Israeli politics, and or it's one step that is needed before Israel annexes the West Bank, which is, it's not, you know, it's very possible that Israel may annex the West Bank, and then the U.S., with that illegal issue resolved, that is no longer on the table, then the U.S., blesses that and says, so what, it's okay, just like they annexed occupied Jerusalem and the U.S. blessed it, just like they annexed the Golan, the Syrian Golan Heights, and the U.S. blessed it.
Yeah, I do think this is definitely a precursor for the annexation of the Israeli annexation of the West Bank. I think it definitely sets the stage for that, and which would not be surprising at the end of the day anyway. But I also do believe this is also something that will that's related to perhaps the politics in Israel with Benjamin Netanyahu, and that's also tied to everything that's happened in Gaza as well. And you know, Netanyahu has had electoral issues, and of course his corruption cases and like criminal cases. He might be prosecuted for that. So I think it's a mixture of both things.
That was a portion of an interview I conducted in 2019 with Mohammed Mohammed, Executive Director of the Jerusalem Fund and the Palestine Center. And in January of 2019, on January 2nd, I aired an interview I conducted live with Daniel McAdams, Executive Director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, where we talked about Syria. Let's take a listen to a portion of that interview. So I'm sure you've heard the announcement of President Donald Trump about Syria. The United States has been involved in bombing and destroying Syria for several years. He made an announcement last week via Twitter, his usual channel of communication to the world, and he said, and I quote, "We have defeated ISIS in Syria. My only reason for being there during the Trump presidency." He later released a video in which he clarified more, saying, "We've been fighting for a long time in Syria. I've been president for almost 2 years, and we've really stepped it up. And we have won against ISIS. We've beaten them, and we've beaten them badly. We've taken back the land, and now it's time for our troops to come back home." Your take and reaction to this announcement?
Well, I think the most interesting reaction, actually, is the reaction in Washington, D.C., and primarily among the neoconservatives, among many, sadly enough, on the progressive side and the liberal side and on the mainstream media. It's just amazing that when president after president takes us into wars overseas with zero congressional authorization, nobody says a word. In fact, they cheer him on. In fact, when President Trump, using faulty intelligence, made the stupid idea to bomb Syria last year, and early this year, the press cheered him on. But if a president ever dares to say, you know what, we're going to end a war, then Washington goes haywire, and that's because war is the lifeblood of the Washington machine.
And we are still involved in so many wars in the Middle East and around the world, and we are still in Iraq big time. Today, President Trump made a surprise visit to Iraq, actually. I don't know if he's still there now, but this is just over the last few, 2-3 hours was announced.
Yes, it's amazing, and it shows a lot. After the neocon-inspired, again, lie-based invasion of Iraq starting in 2003, how many years has the U.S. been in Iraq? And still the president has to fly in under the dark of night in secret. And from what I've read in press reports, he wasn't met by any high-ranking official in the Iraqi government for the main reason that they had no idea he was coming. So what does that say after the so-called cakewalk that we were going to have in 2003 when the neocons said they will welcome us as liberators, that a president can't even still fly in there? because we're hated so much. It says so much about our interventionist foreign policy and the disaster of the neocons.
There are even reports that he wanted to meet with the Iraqi president and some other officials at a U.S. military base, and they have declined that request.
Yeah, which is fascinating. It is, really. I mean, and apparently they had no idea he was coming, and I guess they didn't feel like getting out there.
Yeah. Now, regarding the U.S. troops currently in Syria, I think there are about 2,000 or so troops there, and they occupy a significant part, actually, of Syria right now. And this is just one of the U.S.'s involvement there, but they have been involved in bombing Syria over the last 8 years or so. So they are part of this campaign against Syria that has been really destroyed by so many different factors and external powers, big time.
And that's unfortunately what happens when the U.S. government allows itself to get sucked in to conflicts that has no business being involved in, that have nothing to do with the U.S. national interest. You know, we get sucked in at the behest of some of our allies in the region. The Israelis and the Saudis were big on sucking the U.S. into the Syria fight. And as you point out, the U.S. occupies, I think, territory the size of the country of Croatia, from what I've read. And actually, recently, information came out that we apparently have twice as many troops as we thought, up to about 4,000. And that doesn't tell you anything about how many does the CIA have in there, how many do the contractors have in there. So it's, again, it's an absolute disaster. And as you point out, going on for years, we flattened places like Raqqa. It looks like a moonscape. Talk about another terrible, terrible disaster.
President Trump claims that the U.S. has defeated ISIS, this terrorist group that has been operating in Syria. And many actually have been accusing the United States and others of funding ISIS and giving it arms, whether directly or indirectly somehow, to wreak havoc in Syria. What's your reaction to that? What's your take on ISIS and how it's been operating in Syria anyway?
Well, I have two opinions about that, actually, because, you know, partly I think if the president wants to believe that the U.S. has gone in there and we came in on a white horse and we defeated ISIS and now it's time to come home, I almost don't want to tell him that's not true, because I think at the end of the day, the benefit from him doing that outweighs the potential downside of telling him he's completely wrong. The U.S. hasn't been at the forefront of fighting ISIS, as we know, and in fact, both knowingly and knowingly and unknowingly, the U.S. has funded, trained, and armed radical jihadist groups in Syria with a boneheaded idea that somehow they would overthrow the Syrian government and then all turn into a bunch of nice Democrats and the country ends up like Switzerland. So, yeah, as I say, I'm of two minds. Let him believe that if that's what it takes to get the U.S. out of there.
This is really interesting, and there are so many different countries involved in Syria, neighboring countries and Western powers, Europe, Britain, you know, of course, and others, in addition to the United States. So with this announcement of the withdrawal, you mentioned there are reports, obviously, double what we thought we have there, almost 4,000 troops. He announced that within 60 to 90 days, I believe he said, that they will be withdrawing the troops from Syria, that is to be seen. Yes, he promised that during the campaign, if you recall, that he said he will withdraw from Syria. But also he promised dozens of other things, and he violated them all, complete lies, never implemented promises, and so on. So that is yet to be believed, actually, that we're yet to see whether they will actually withdraw or not. And even if they withdraw, we don't know whether the U.S. will stop its bombing campaign on Syria. Will they end the sanctions? Because there is a whole lot more at stake here.
That's true, and we don't know whether he'll follow through with it. And unfortunately, you know, he's created his own problems largely in his administration. He did run on the idea of the U.S. not only getting out of Syria, but ending all of the stupid wars and getting out of some of these organizations like NATO that just look around for trouble around the world. But he's appointed a lot of people to his administration that have the opposite view. He appointed the same old Washington hacks that are in every administration, the same neocons, the same people who make their living off of the military-industrial complex. I look at all the think tankers in Washington and look who funds them. They're all funded by Lockheed Martin. They're funded by the people who make the death machines. So in a way, he promised to drain the swamp, but then he hired everyone in his administration who makes a living off of the swamp. So in a way, he's making his own nightmare if he is to believe that he actually wants to get us out of these. And I think there's a side of him that really does want to get us out of these wars.
What about Russia's involvement? We know Russia supports the Syrian regime, and they have been involved militarily also there. Iran definitely supports the Syrian regime, and they have been involved to some extent also in Syria. How do you see that playing if the U.S. really withdraws completely from Syria?
What I always find amazing, especially among American pundits, is the idea that no other country but America is allowed to have allies. You know, I mean, we have our NATO allies, we have all these allies around the world, and when Syria, by necessity, finds itself allying with Russia, who is a long-term friend of Syria, and with Iran, because they share some of the same opponents in the region, all of a sudden it's illegitimate, as if a sovereign state is not allowed to call in some of its friends and neighbors, saying, hey, we're about to get taken over by your enemies too, people that you're concerned about. Would you mind lending a hand? That somehow that's illegitimate. And of course, you know, nobody stops in the U.S. to wonder, this doesn't sound right. You know, this doesn't sound, this doesn't make a lot of sense why nobody else but us can have allies.
Exactly. And, you know, the U.S. somehow always feels that it's its way or the highway when it comes to that. You talked about the military-industrial complex. They've been creating wars, and they wreak havoc throughout the world. They've been, arming Iraq, and they've been arming Iran during the Iraq-Iran war so many years ago. And we've seen it throughout. I mean, they are truly wreaking havoc in so many different countries throughout the world, and especially in the Middle East. And then they talk about, you know, we are there to protect the people. We are there for human rights, which is way, way far from the truth.
Well, absolutely. Look at Libya. How are the human rights over in Libya these days, you know? Every place that the neocons, every place that the war hawks, the chicken hawks, every place they've had their way has turned into a disaster. And really, the main thing that we focus on in the Ron Paul Institute and in our daily Ron Paul Liberty Report broadcast is trying to wake the American people up. You guys are getting ripped off. They're trying to sell you this as some kind of a patriotic thing. But it's not. There are a small, very well-connected group of people who are getting filthy rich off of these wars. And meanwhile, millions of people are dying in the Middle East and elsewhere. The families are growing up to hate America. And even if you're only concerned about your own self and your own security, that is creating a great risk to the United States being so hated for its foreign policy. And so we're trying to wake American people up. These people are destroying the economy and threatening our security. That's why we want to change our foreign policy.
So there you have it, just a small portion of many interviews we conducted on Arab Voices in 2019. We do have an archive section online at our website where you can download or listen online to any of our previous programs over the past, getting close to 18 years now. And that website is www.arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening and Happy New Year. People of Earth is coming up next. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on Earth.
And there you have it, a recap of 2019 and all the craziness that happened. You heard a song in my show from Shadia Mansour called El Kufi Al Arabiye, one of my favorite songs, amazing artist, as well as a clip from Arab Voices. If you missed any part of this show, go to kboo.fm/onelandmanyvoices and you can listen to any part of my episode there. Thanks for tuning in. Have a great day.
من هيك لبسنا الكوفية
لأنها وطنية
الكوفية كوفية عربية من هيك لبسنا الكوفية
هويتنا الأساسية
الكوفية كوفية عربية يلا علي الكوفية
علولي هالكوفية
الكوفية كوفية عربية
علو هلا بلاد الشام كوفية عربية بتضل عربية
Some of y'all think it's a trend, a fashion statement. Disgustingly, I I spit on the pavement. It's basic. Y'all know I bang for my flag. My bandana ain't no rag. The keffiyeh ain't no scarf. It's a part of the movement. The symbolism is resistance. No coincidence that you can see the RBG in it. Cable meet the bandera. Ain't it beautiful? I say it in Spanish. It's solidarity. The feelings is mutual.
KBOO proudly co-sponsors the Portland Folk Music Society's concert series featuring Sam Ryder and the Human Hands, an ensemble from the worlds of jazz and folk music. The show is Friday, February 21st, 7:30 p.m. at the Reedwood Friends Church in Southeast Portland. Sam Ryder has been a U.S. State Department musical ambassador, taking his accordion to at least six nations. For 6 years, Ryder has been band leader for Jazz at the Lincoln Center's youth program. The Human Hands feature the violin stylings of Oregonian Alex Hargraves. For more information about the Portland Folk Music Society concert series, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 10 a.m., and we're going to jump into Voices for the Animals, tackling issues around animal rights with interviews of frontline activists who are working to make a difference in the lives of animals around the world. We'll finish out the hour at 10:30 with Film at 11, a panel broadcast reviewing the latest films and shows from the multiplex to the art house and beyond. At 11, we will wrap up the morning with Rising Up with Sonali, all of which we can do with the support of the audience. That's the community. That's you. Become a member of the KBOO Foundation at kboo.fm. Or you can use the mobile app. You just click where it says donate. Keep an eye out for some rain and showers for the next week. Highs in the 50s and lows in the 40s. Don't you wish you had a hoodie with a KBOO logo on it?